You're listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. Welcome to the reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Wednesday, October 21st, 2020. I'm Alex Lemke from Drake University. Here is your first story. Iowa Western reports 14 new COVID-19 cases among students. Iowa Western Community College had more new cases of COVID-19 reported during the period of October 11th through 17th, but active cases were down among students. Iowa Western had 14 new cases of COVID-19 among students for the week, compared with 11 during the period of October 4th through 10th, according to Don Kohler, Vice President of Marketing and Public Relations. There were 15 recoveries, leaving 11 active cases, down from 17 the previous week. The college had 7 newly reported cases among staff members compared with 2 the previous week and 2 recoveries, Kohler said, leaving 9 active cases, up from 4 the week before. There were 19 new cases over a 24-hour period in Pottawatomie County, according to the state COVID-19 website, coronavirus.iowa.gov. There were 2,967 cases out of 25,310 tests at 3 p.m. on Tuesday. There were 2,185 recoveries in the county. There have been 44 COVID-19 deaths. The county's 14-day rolling average positivity rate dipped slightly to 13.3%. Mills County Public Health reported 45 new cases for the week ending Monday. The county has 337 cases out of 4,372 tests on Tuesday, according to the state, with 175 recoveries and 1 death. Mills County 14-day rate was 9.9% on Tuesday. Symptoms in people who have been exposed to coronavirus can include fever, cough, and shortness of breath, according to the Iowa Department of Public Health. The symptoms may appear in as few as 2 days or as long as 14 days after exposure. Most people experience mild or moderate symptoms that clear up in 2 to 3 weeks. Older adults and people with existing health problems are among those particularly susceptible to more severe illness, including pneumonia. Public health officials recommend wearing face coverings, especially when 6 feet of distance, if not possible. Avoid large gatherings, self-monitor for symptoms, call your physician if symptoms appear, cover coughs and sneezes with a tissue or your upper arm or elbow, clean and disinfect frequently touched objects and surfaces, wash hands frequently with soap and water. COVID-19 testing is available in Pottawatomie County via 2 Test Iowa locations, All Care Health Center at 902 South 6th Street, and Western Historic Trails Center, 3434 Richard Downing Avenue. To get tested, residents must complete an online assessment at testiowa.com to schedule an appointment. For those struggling with mental health during the pandemic, yourlifeiowa.org has several resources, including a hotline at 855-581-8111 and a text-friendly line at 855-895-8398. The University of Nebraska Medical Center has a COVID-19 screening app, -1-CheckCOVID. All right, our next story will be Barack Obama joins campaign trail today, Trump-Biden debate paths vary, CMT Music Awards tonight. Today is Wednesday, October 21st, 2020. Let's get caught up. These headlines are in the news this morning. Former President Barack Obama will hold his first in-person event for Joe Biden in Philadelphia today. President Trump rallies in Pennsylvania while Joe Biden preps for debate, and the CMT Music Awards are tonight. Read on for these stories, other top headlines, celebrity birthdays, and more. Top stories, Barack Obama to hold his first in-person event for Joe Biden. Former President Barack Obama is returning to Philadelphia on Wednesday for his first in-person 2020 campaign event for Joe Biden. In 2016, the man known as one of the Democratic Party's strongest orators, delivered Hillary Clinton's closing argument in the same place at a rally for thousands the night before Election Day in Independence Hall, or on Independence Hall. Now, with the coronavirus pandemic upending campaigning, Obama will be speaking to a much smaller crowd at a drive-in rally where the supporters will listen to him over the radio inside their cars. Next headline for this story, Trump tends to his electoral map, Biden prepping for debate. President Donald Trump is hoping for one must-win stop on the electoral map to the next in the lead-up to a final presidential debate that may be his last best chance to alter the trajectory of the 2020 campaign. Democrat Joe Biden has been taking the opposite approach, holding up for debate prep in advance of Thursday's face-off in Nashville, Tennessee. Trump, trailing in polls in most battleground sites, stopped in Pennsylvania on Tuesday and was bound for North Carolina on Wednesday as he delivers what his campaign sees as his closing message. The third headline is CMT Music Awards to feature trio of hosts outdoor stages. A trio of new hosts will lead fans through a new look at this year's CMT Music Awards, which replaced the live arena audience with performances in scenic outdoor locations around Nashville, Tennessee. Country singers Kane Brown and Ashley McBride joined Modern Family actor Sarah Hyland as co-hosts during Wednesday night's show airing on CMT, MTV, MTV2, Logo, Paramount Network, Pop, and TV Land. Finalists for the top award, Video of the Year, were narrowed down to Carrie Underwood, Keith Urban, Kelsey Ballerini, Luke Combs, Miranda Lambert, and Tanya Tucker, who was a first-time nominee as well. All right, next. Ericsson earnings boosted by 5G network rollouts. Swedish telecom equipment maker Ericsson has reported upbeat third-quarter earnings, helped mainly by the rollout of 5G wireless networks in China and across, and a strong U.S. market. The Stockholm-based company said Wednesday that net profit for the July-September period was 5.6 billion kronor, which is $640 million, compared with a loss of 6.9 billion kroner the previous year. Sales were up 1% at 57.5 billion kroner. Ericsson CEO Börje Ekholm said that the company's contracts for the next generation 5G networks in mainland China have developed according to plan, contributing positively to profits in quarter three and are expected to improve further. Ekholm also pointed to the North American market where underlying business fundamentals remain strong, driven by a consolidation in the market and increased demand for 5G, the new generation rapid mobile networks. Ericsson competes in the 5G business with China's Huawei and Finland's Nokia and two other main global network suppliers. North Korea's Samsung has too made inroads to the network business in the past few years and recently scored a lucrative multi-billion dollar 5G deal with major U.S. carrier Verizon Wireless. Ericsson said it now has 112 commercial 5G agreements with 65 live networks with different operators. Nordic rival Nokia plays catch-up, saying on its webpage that it has secured 101 commercial 5G deals with 36 live networks as of October 21st. However, the Nordic duo still trails market leader Huawei with unconfirmed 5G deals. Ericsson and Nokia said separately on Wednesday that they've landed a network deal with the Swedish telecom operator Telia, the Nordic region's leading mobile carrier. The news comes a day after Sweden banned Huawei from 5G networks over allegations it can allow the Chinese government to snoop on data. Huawei denies the allegations. Ericsson said it would upgrade Telia's 4G network in Sweden and Estonia, while Nokia said it would deploy a 5G network for Telia in Finland and act as a supplier to its 5G standalone networks in various countries in the region. Nokia will report its third quarter earnings on October 29th. Our next article is Arrest Made in 21-Year-Old Murder Case of Council Bluffs Woman. An arrest has been made in the 1999 murder case of a Council Bluffs woman. On Friday, Council Bluffs police detectives requested and were granted an arrest warrant for Matt W. Kennedy, accusing him of first-degree murder. Detectives allege that Kennedy was involved in a brutal murder of his stepsister, Kimberly M. Ratliff, the Council Bluffs Police Department said in a press release. Matt Kennedy, 52, is a resident in Fairfield, Montana. He was living in Council Bluffs at the time of the murder. Kennedy was taken into custody and is being held in the Teton County Jail pending extradition to Iowa. The case remains an active investigation, police said. Police also said no further information will be released regarding Kennedy's arrest until he's back in Iowa. The long-standing cold case has drawn a great deal of interest from the public over a two-decade span. In the year following the murder, police reported that they had a strong feeling about who the perpetrator of the crime was. However, charges were never levied. We have strong suspicions on who committed the crime or who was involved, but in a criminal case, the prosecution has a tremendous burden of proof, and right now we don't have enough to back up our suspicions in court, said then Captain Lindsay Anderson, head of the detective division, during a 2000 interview with the Omaha World Herald. On the morning of January 12, 1999, Ratliff was discovered inside her white 1988 Plymouth Sundance, which had been abandoned in the 1400 block of West Broadway. After being missing for about 3.5 days, the 22-year-old's body was found by a People's Natural Gas employee who was clearing snow from the sidewalk, boarding the business's Council Bluff offices, according to World Herald archives. Ratliff's body was found sprawled across the front seat, her throat slashed, according to archive reports. She was last seen alive when she got off work from Airlite Plastics Company, an Omaha business, around 11:30 on a Friday evening. Her mother, Joyce Kennedy, and Matt Kennedy both worked for the company at the time as well. Prior to her death, Ratliff lived with her mother and stepfather, Les Kennedy, near 3rd Street and 16th Avenue. Ratliff was a 1995 graduate of Lewis Central High School and took courses at Nebraska College of Business and became a paralegal but dropped out after a year, according to archive stories. Jacques Ratliff, Kimberly Ratliff's father, told the Nonpareil in 2016 that he still struggles to sleep at night because memories of taking Kimberly to the park pop in his head. He said he remembers her as a happy person who deserved an ending to her story. We believe justice will take place, I really do, he said at the time. Joyce Kennedy told the World Herald in 2008 she didn't want to discuss the case at length because it was too painful, saying, it gets harder and harder every year. Messages from the Nonpareil to the Council Bluffs Police Department and Pottawatomie County Attorney's Office weren't immediately returned. Next, Bluffs man sentenced to 20 years for sexual misconduct with child. A Council Bluffs man was sentenced to a lengthy prison term this week after being found guilty of sexual misconduct with a child. Brian Center, 56, was sentenced to 20 years in prison by Judge Craig Dreismeyer in district court after pleading guilty to two counts of committing lascivious I'm not sure how to pronounce that, lascivious acts with child, Class C felonies, according to the Pottawatomie County Attorney's Office. Center received 10 years on both charges, which will run consecutively one after the other, in the Iowa Department of Corrections. The defendant was previously convicted of two counts of sexually abusing a child in Polk County in 1997, according to Assistant County Attorney Melina Dobson. According to Dobson, a victim under the age of 10 disclosed the ongoing abuse at school during Ready, Set, Know, a project overseen by the Iowa State University Extension and Outreach Office designed to prevent child abuse and emphasize safety through classroom lessons. I'm thankful for the Ready, Set, Know program because it gives children a unique opportunity to discuss a topic that is difficult to broach, Dobson said, through a prepared statement to the Nonpareil. Dobson added that the plea agreement was ultimately a positive for the child and any potential future victims. This plea agreement spares the child additional drama from the trial process while also protecting society from Mr. Center, she said. Voting rights restoration creates 2,550 new voters in Iowa. The voting rights of roughly 35,000 felons in Iowa who had completed their sentences were restored this summer by an executive order, but as of August, only 2,550, roughly 7% of those newly eligible, had registered to vote for this fall's election, according to Iowa Secretary of State data. For advocates who had been pressing for the automatic restoration of voting rights for Iowa felons who complete their sentences, that number represents a good start, but also shows how much work remains. On the one hand, it's great that over 2,500 people have become eligible to vote and have exercised that right by registering, said Mark Stringer, executive director of the Iowa chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union. However, Stringer said that the number is also disappointingly low. We have to continue to try to elevate this opportunity for folks, Stringer said. Chan Yilmaz, a Cedar Rapids woman, said she was one of the 2,550 Iowans who registered to vote after having those rights restored by Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds' executive order, which automatically restored the voting rights to any felon in Iowa who had completed his or her sentence. Before the order, those individuals were required to petition the governor directly to have their voting rights restored. Iowa was the last state in the nation with that requirement. Yilmaz said she was convicted of a felony in 2002 while living in California. The Iowa native was eligible to vote in California after completing her sentence. She said she voted there in the 2016 election but could not vote in Iowa when she returned here in 2017. Yilmaz voted early and in person on Tuesday afternoon with a friend. I'm very excited. I can't wait, Yilmaz said before voting. When I voted in 2016, I wore that I voted button all around. I never took it off. It's important to me. Betty Andrews, president of the Iowa and Nebraska chapters of the NAACP, said stories like Yilmaz's were a good start, but only a start. We celebrate that thousands of people were now able to exercise their right to vote and have voice as citizens, Andrews said in an email. 2,550 newly empowered voters in less than a month is an admirable start and could make a difference in an election. We are working to see these numbers rise. Advocates said that one potential hurdle to felons registering to vote could be the confusing nature of the issue over recent years. Reynolds's executive order this summer was the latest tilt of a years-long seesaw. In 2005, Democratic Governor Tom Vilsack issued an executive order restoring the voting rights of felons who complete their sentences, but in 2011, Republican Governor Terry Branstad rescinded that order. Reynolds, a Republican, and Branstad's lieutenant governor from 2011 to 2017, broke from her predecessor and said that she supports the automatic restoration of voting rights for felons who complete their sentences. But instead of issuing another executive order, she spent roughly a year and a half urging state lawmakers to begin the process of amending the state constitution. Reynolds said she preferred the method because it would be more permanent and not subject to the whims of ensuing governors. Lawmakers in 2019 and 2020 began the lengthy process of amending the state constitution, but the process stalled when some Senate Republicans in particular wanted to add requirements that felons pay all of their court fees and fines before being eligible. After the Iowa legislature failed to reach an agreement on the issue this year, Reynolds switched course, issuing her executive order on August 5th. Governor Reynolds will continue to advocate for a constitutional amendment regarding felon voting rights, which would be a permanent solution to this issue, Reynolds spokesman Pat Garrett said in an email. In the meantime, her office will continue to work with local county auditors and the Iowa Secretary of State's office to help any individual looking to navigate this process and vote this year. We also continue to get a lot of positive feedback from individuals who are able to vote this year because of the executive order. Reynolds's order restored the voting rights of nearly 35,000 individuals, according to the Iowa Secretary of State's office. An unknown portion of these could be non-Iowa residents, a spokesperson from the office noted. As of August, 2,550 Iowans newly eligible as a result of the governor's order had registered to vote, according to the Secretary of State's office. Of those 2,550 newly registered voters, 811 registered as Democrats, 745 as Republicans, 53 as Libertarians, 34 with the Green Party, and a plurality, 907, registered with no political party, according to the office. My goal is for every eligible Iowan to register to vote and participate in elections, Secretary of State Paul Pate said in a statement. I agree with Governor Reynolds that Iowans who have served their time deserve a second chance and should be able to make their voices heard by voting. It's good to see more than 2,500 have nearly stepped up and registered to vote since early August. A spokesman for the Secretary of State's office encouraged by Iowans interested to visit restoreyourvote.iowa.gov for more information. Stringer said that the ACLU had similar information available at youcanvoteiowa.org. Next, shining light on the dark, retired Bluffs firefighter discusses battle with PTSD. The darkness didn't cloak now retired Council Bluffs firefighter Captain Dave Hyde in one fell swoop. Rather, its presence grew with each emergency response, slowly extinguishing the light within the 23-year department veteran. Though he'd been bothered by what the job entailed before, what he considered to be a normal human response to seeing death and destruction, an incident in 2010 left him emotionally rattled. It's ultimately jump-started his battle with post-traumatic stress disorder. It was my first house fire with a child death, and I was first arriving captain on scene. I made the calls, Hyde said. We tried desperately to get him out of that house, but I felt like I failed. That was the first one that ever emotionally impacted me. I literally went away someplace by myself and broke down. You're grieving the loss of a 9-year-old you couldn't save. I mean, my job here, the reason the city pays me, is to save people in fires. And I had just failed at my job. It's how I felt and how I internalized it. The feeling of personal failure, defeat, and anguish swept over Hyde again in May 2011, when his crew was unable to rescue a man who succumbed to smoke inhalation during a house fire. It was a very smoky fire, hoarder conditions in the house, just impossible to get around, he said. Firefighters were told by neighbors that the home tenant worked nights and likely wasn't home. Still, Hyde entered and completed a sweep to ensure the neighbors were correct. Maneuvering through the house, he said he was at near zero visibility. Hyde came upon a jammed door. I pushed and pushed and pushed and pushed on this door. I leaned into it with everything I had, he said. I couldn't get it. We thought there was a bunch of garbage piled up there, you know? After doing a room search down the hall, which took about a minute, Hyde returned and watched the ladder company use forcible entry tools to access the room. They chopped the door down, and there was a guy leaning up against it, and I couldn't get it open, Hyde said. I missed it. I did not find him. I killed him. That's really how I felt, and that was 8 months after the child died. Hyde officially stepped away from the fire department in February and was recognized for his service Thursday during a ceremony at the Council Bluffs Fire Station. There was a bell-ringing ceremony, a celebratory cake, and recognition given by Fire Chief Justin James and Mayor Matt Walsh. The last to speak was Hyde himself, something he dreaded, because he said he knew his speech wasn't going to be a feel-good, off into retirement I go deal. If he was going to address his peers, he said he had to highlight the importance of mental health on the job and the toll emergency call after emergency call can take. It wasn't something he thought he was up for. I was absolutely filled with dread because I had to come here and do this, Hyde told the nonpareil. I didn't want to do this. I was not going to do this, but my wife and daughters were adamant that I do this. And I am so glad I did. I didn't think I'd ever get with a group of firefighters like this and say that stuff. The words he said matter. The Firefighter Behavioral Health Alliance reported 119 firefighters and 20 emergency medical technicians and paramedics died by suicide in 2019, while 82 firefighters and 21 EMTs took their own life in 2018. Even in a time where stigmas against mental health issues are diminishing in many careers, firefighters, EMTs, and paramedics oftentimes still refuse to open up about traumas they experience, he said. James spoke candidly about some of the difficulties associated with firefighting. I'd say that about 25 years is all that a human should have to take of it, and unfortunately that's not always the case, James said, referencing department retirement requirements. I think that things start bothering people more, and it can be harder to deal with the older you get. You start thinking more and more about it when you were 22 or 25, and over time that can wear on you. The stress and guilt and anger continued wearing on Hyde long after the 2010 and 2011 incidents, but in 2015 he was able to channel some of his distress into something positive for the department. Attending a seminar in Washington, D.C., Hyde learned about the benefits of a peer support system. I was sick at the time. I was not only looking at its total value, I was hoping it was something that could help me, Hyde said. Hyde said he received funding and support through the Firefighters Union to help install a local program, one where trained Bluffs department members could discuss openly and candidly with team members struggling about what they were experiencing, essentially acting as a lifeline. Prior to the inception of peer support locally, Hyde said he and his firefighter cohorts would exclusively undergo critical incident stress debriefings following traumatic incidents. Representatives outside of the force would come in and elect Hyde and others to talk about what they experienced and what they were feeling. And firemen don't talk about shit like this, Hyde said, because if you do, you're weak. So what would always happen at these meetings is what we would sit in a room and nobody would say anything. So somebody smarter than me, I don't know who, thought up peer support. Though Hyde is gone from the department, peer support remains a valuable tool for the force, James said. And we're going to be doing peer support among other things, James said. There's all kinds of stresses that can obviously get to you in life, and the fire department adds an extreme amount of additional stress. And though the job took its toll, Hyde emphasized that he loved many aspects of his work. In fact, being a firefighter was really the only job he ever wanted. So when he stepped away earlier this year, there was an immediate void. The day after I retired, I felt like a different person, Hyde said. I felt like I lost part of my identity. It's been my life. Firemen hanging out with firemen. Firemen talk a certain way. It's really a true brotherhood. And then the next day, you're not that guy anymore, and you're 51 years old, and you're saying, what the hell am I going to do now? I mean, I know a lot of things, but I've spent a third of my life here every year for the past 23 years. Stepping away from fire and emergency calls hasn't eliminated Hyde's PTSD. He knows it's something he will likely deal with for the rest of his life, but he's hoping some positive changes can come out of everything. He said he meets with a therapist and has a large group of supporters in his corner from around the country dealing with similar adverse circumstances, others trying to claw their way out of the darkness and into the light. So now, tackling his new life path, Hyde said it's time to keep moving in the right direction, one step at a time. I'm really trying to not think too far ahead, he said, because when you think too far ahead about where you're going when you deal with this thing, PTSD, you also tend to think about all the problems you're going to have to deal with in the next 3 years. It's kind of like the AA thing. It's just one day at a time. You're listening to the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for October 21st, 2020 on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped in Des Moines. I'm Alex Lemke from Drake University. IRIS volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about this or any IRIS program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 877-404-4747. Next for sports, Matt Calkins, number 3, is the clear number 1. Why the MVP award is Russell Wilson's to lose. There was one guy right there with him. One guy matching his efficiency. One guy whose production challenged the narrative that the NFL's MVP resides in the state of Washington. Heading into Sunday's game versus Tampa Bay, Packers quarterback Aaron Rodgers had put up numbers as good, if not better, than Seahawks quarterback Russell Wilson. His passer rating was just 1 point below. His QBR, considered a more advanced metric, was higher, presumably because he had taken 12 fewer sacks than Wilson. His team was also undefeated and posting 38 points per game. Then Sunday happened when Aaron was just plain awful. Folks, we may be only a third of the way through the season, but the NFL MVP award is now Wilson's to lose. There is nobody in the league who has been as precise or consistent. Nobody who has been this tough to slow down. Before Rodgers went 16 for 35 with 2 interceptions and no touchdowns in Sunday's 38-10 loss to the Bucks, you could say Russ had competition. Now number 3 is the clear number 1, so where does he go from here? Remember, this isn't the first time Wilson was considered the MVP favorite 5 games into the season. He had a similarly immaculate start last year, then dropped off in the second half. But something about this year feels different. Something about Wilson's play in 2020 suggests that his dominance will continue in the weeks to come. For one, he has DK Metcalf. Yes, the receiver was part of Wilson's arsenal last year, but he hadn't blossomed into the nightmare he has become in his second season. Through five games, Metcalf's 99.2 yards per game are third in the NFL, and his 22.5 yards per catch are tops in the league. Wilson has had productive pass catchers throughout his time with the Seahawks, names such as Doug Baldwin, Jimmy Graham, and Golden Tate come to mind, but he has never had someone as dynamic as 2020 Metcalf. Russell has made a career out of spreading the ball around, but to have to go to a receiver who caught two fourth down passes on the Seahawks' final drive in their last game makes him more dangerous than he has ever been. He also appears to have a bit more freedom this season. Wilson has thrown 169 passes this year compared to 156 through five games last year, and 50 of those passes from last season came against the Saints, who took a commanding lead early and forced the Seahawks to throw. But now it appears letting Russ cook has become a part of their weekly game plan. Seattle offensive coordinator Brian Schottenheimer insists that the team's run-first strategy hasn't changed, but that hasn't been reflected on the field. Whether they're up or down, the Seahawks are throwing, and when you have a guy playing as well as Wilson is, why wouldn't you? Wilson's passer rating of 129.8 is nearly 14 points higher than anyone else in the league. His 19 touchdown passes are number one by five. He has averaged 300.4 passing yards per game, good for fourth in the NFL, and he has tossed just three interceptions, one of which bounced right off tight end Greg Olsen's hands. One of the more fascinating aspects to this season is how little Seahawks coach Pete Carroll gets asked about Wilson after games. Normally, scribes go fishing for quotes after a spectacular performance by a given player, but that has seldom been the case with Russell this season. The reason? His otherworldly performances have commonplace. It has become like prime Wilt Chamberlain dropping a paltry 48 points. Back to Rodgers for a second. The Super Bowl winner has long held the best career passer rating, with Wilson in second place. That is still true, but the gap has never been this narrow. Sunday's disaster dropped Rodgers' career rating to 102.6, keeping him just ahead of Wilson, who's at 102.4. I suspect before the season is over, Wilson takes the top spot. He has simply been too good. Wilson is playing better football right now, and frankly, it's not even all that close. Visit the Seattle Times at www.seattletimes.com. Here are the obituaries for October 21st, 2020. Steve M. Elenich, 1959 through 2020. Justin E. Fruick. Dorcas E. Gibson, 1942 through 2020. Yvonne Mary Hanneman, 1924 through 2020. Dr. James Hartier and Jack C. Perkins, 1929 through 2020. Next for sports, bullpen saved. Dodgers keep Jansen and Co. fresh for Game 2. Winning Game 1 was a sweet way to start the World Series for the Los Angeles Dodgers. The cherry on top, all the big arms left on ice. Kenley Jansen, Blake Treinen, and Bruce Dar Gratterall should be fresh for Wednesday after watching the Dodgers' 8-3 victory over the Tampa Bay Rays in Game 1. Clayton Kershaw provided six tidy innings, and Los Angeles closed it out without exhausting the back of its bullpen. The pitching-wary Dodgers couldn't have a scripted better start. They pushed their top arms hard in the NL Championship Series, which came down to a Game 7 on Sunday. Starting pitchers Walker Buehler, Julio Urias, Tony Gonsolin, and Dustin May each took the mound during an all-hands-on-deck effort to close out the series over the weekend. Aces of October's past, like Bob Gibson where Tom Seaver might have rushed back on short rest for the World Series. Manager Dave Roberts is being more cautious with his number one starter, keeping Buehler on regular rest for Game 3. That leaves a hole for Game 2 where nobody figures to be fresh enough for a starter's workload. The Dodgers announced that after Game 1, that Gonsolin would pitch first, but the right-hander should be on a short leash after throwing 41 pitches on Sunday. A 26-year-old NL Rookie of the Year contender, Gonsolin's best pitch is a hard-driving splitter that's equally effective against righties and lefties, advantageous against the Rays' balanced lineup. "We just like him in this spot," Robert said. May could cover multiple innings after throwing just 18 pitches Sunday. Roberts said Urias also would be available through LA, although LA would surely like to save him for a potential start in Game 4. "With a day off Thursday, everyone else will be available. The biggest spots will undoubtedly go to Jansen, Thainen, and Gratterall." Jansen is trying to shake postseason demons recent and past. He has blown more saves, 3, than he has converted, 2, in 2 previous World Series visits, including consecutive botched chances against Boston in Game 3 and 4 of the 2018 series. The three-time All-Star lost the zip on his cutter down to the stretch this season, and Roberts removed him from the closer's role after a lousy outing against San Diego during the division series. Jansen got a week off between outings, corrected his mechanics, and delivered 3 perfect outings against Atlanta, including a save in Game 6. "You know, once it clicked, everything is going to come with it," Jansen said afterward. "It was as good as I've seen in quite some time," Roberts added. The Rays have 2018 Cy Young Award winner Blake Snell tabbed for Game 2. Manager Kevin Cash, uncharacteristically slow to pull starter Kaylor Glasnow in Game 1, also has fresh arms in the bullpen after riding mop-up lefty Josh Flemings to cover in the late innings Tuesday. Snell was allowed to throw just 82 pitches in the ALCS Game 6. Cash figures to be equally aggressive in getting to Nick Anderson, Pete Fairbanks, and the rest of his stable of guys who throw 98 miles per hour, as he described them in September. More AP MLB link https://apnews.com/MLB and https://twitter.com/AP-sports. Lewis Central sweeps ADM, advances to regional semifinal. Lewis Central continued its winning ways with a sweep over Adel DeSoto Minburn in the Class 4A Region 2 quarterfinals on Tuesday at Lewis Central High School. The Class 4A No. 12 Titans took care of business, winning 3-0, 25-15, 25-16, 25-15, extending their win streak to 5 straight, while also winning 11 of their last 12 sets. Lewis Central head coach Mike Bond credits a consistent effort in practice and how his team has played down the stretch and so far over one gamer in the postseason. "Throughout the season, every time we come into practice, we make the decision we want to get better," Bond said. "I really like the way this team communicates, plays together, and they really work hard as a team." This victory punches the Titans' ticket to the 4A regional semifinals, where they'll go on the road to face Harlan 16-13 on Thursday at 7 p.m. The winner of Thursday's game advances to the regional final against the winner of Glenwood 30-2 and winner set 11-15. The regional final will be played at a location to be determined on Tuesday, October 27th. In their only meeting in the offseason, Harlan defeated Lewis Central 3-1 on September 22nd. Since that game, Lewis Central is 13-3. "I expect Harlan's best effort," Bond said. "I think it's anyone's match Thursday night, and I think it could very easily be a 5-setter. Tokyo Olympics try to get word out about COVID-19 measures. Tokyo Olympic officials want the world to know They are working on measures to combat the COVID-19 pandemic at next year's games, even if they don't know exactly what they will be. Tokyo organizers showcased a few possible remedies on Wednesday, displaying various screening measures at the city's big site convention complex, the home of the media center for the Olympics. Our objective is to demonstrate what we are doing towards safety and security of the Olympics, said Soyushi Iwashita, the executive director of the Tokyo Olympics Security Bureau. Most of it looked familiar, including hand sanitizers and people passing through scanning devices with guards wearing face shields at the other end. One innovation involved a sticker placed on the wrist to measure body temperature in a few seconds. This time we have tried different methods and analyzed them, Iwashita said. I think there is no right answer, but we still have to think about what we should do. And there are various sports competitions going on, but I think the challenge is to find out what kind of method is suitable for the world's largest sports event, the Tokyo Olympics and Paralympics. It won't be easy or perfect. Athletes around the globe have come down with COVID-19 despite precautions. 10 members of the Italian swim team reported positive for the virus on Tuesday, including world champions Simona Quagliarella and Gabrielle Detti. On the other hand, the NBA recently finished its season without a single positive test. The International Olympic Committee has said that athletes testing positive at the Olympics are likely to be excluded, perhaps extinguishing years of training. The Olympic numbers are huge. 11,000 athletes and thousands of officials, judges, VIPs, volunteers, sponsors, media, and broadcasters. And another 4,400 athletes for the Paralympics. And then inject the question of fans. Will there be any, or will only Japanese be allowed? Finally, factor in the possibility that a vaccine will be ready when the games are to open in July 23rd, 2021. But should athletes be a priority, and should they be compelled to be vaccinated, and who pays for the vaccine? Tokyo organizers and the IOC have said they are testing many scenarios and are unlikely to explain until early next year exactly how the Olympics can be held safely. Their main job now is to convince skeptical sponsors and fans that the games will happen, allowing the IOC to collect billions of dollars from broadcasters and sponsors. Earlier this year, organizers and the IOC waited until March before deciding to postpone the Olympics. Japan has attributed about 1,700 deaths to COVID-19, having escaped soaring fatalities that have affected many other countries. It has also employed strict controls over immigration since the pandemic. Kozu Tano, who works as a security guard, participated in the Wednesday simulations. She talked about the challenge of COVID-19 and also mentioned Tokyo's scorching summer heat. We did a demonstration experience this time and tried to work with a face shield for COVID-19 countermeasures. And even though the temperature was low, I felt the heat, she said. We inspected about 20 people, but in reality, that will not be the case. When it comes to guiding a large number of visitors for a very long time, I am worried that my sweat will drip on the face shield during the hot summer months. Mike McCarthy takes Dallas Cowboys woes personally, says, I'm not getting it done. Dallas Cowboys owner Jerry Jones might not be ready to point the finger at coach Mike McCarthy for the team's dismal 2-4 start, but the coach is taking the blame for the squad's string of slow starts and their terrible turnover tally. I frankly don't want to be rude. I have no assessments for you, McCarthy said, after Monday night's 38-10 blowout loss to the Arizona Cardinals at AT&T Stadium. I think we all understand what the score is. We didn't play very well on offense, defense, or special teams. Most importantly, I didn't coach very well. I have a continuing issue with ball security on my football team. The Cowboys continue to be their own worst enemy. They had a season-high 4 turnovers against the Cardinals and now have 15 of the season. For those, 13 have resulted in opponent scores, including 11 touchdowns. Measured by points, the Cowboys have allowed 74 points off of turnovers this season, the worst mark by any NFL team over the past 20 seasons. That's something I personally take a lot of pride in, and how it reflects on how you play the game of football, McCarthy said. I'm not getting it done right now. Running back Ezekiel Elliott had 4 fumbles in the first half against the Cardinals and was temporarily benched for backup Tony Pollard. Elliott has lost 4 fumbles in the last 6 games after losing 5 in the previous 4 seasons combined. Quarterback Andy Dalton had 2 interceptions on his first start in the place of Dak Prescott, who is out for the season with a fractured right ankle. The Cowboys have had at least 2 turnovers in each of the last 5 games. It's a discouraging period, McCarthy said. It's something that we work diligently on, that's not carried over to the game, that's something we have to just continue to stay after. Maybe, frankly, maybe we're trying too hard, or maybe we're overcoaching. It's just self-inflicted wounds that continue to plague us. Not only is McCarthy frustrated, but he sounds discouraged 6 games into his first season as Cowboys coach. He appears to be a man who doesn't know his football team and has yet to find a way to reach them. As I continue to learn this team, I felt the preparation coming into the game was probably our best so far this year, McCarthy said. But obviously that doesn't even count for anything, particularly after the performance like Monday night. McCarthy refused to blame injuries for the team's woes or loss of confidence, even though the Cowboys are now without 6 starters for the season in Prescott, tackles Tyrion Smith and Lael Collins, tight end Blake Jarwin, and defensive tackles Gerald McCoy and Tristan Hill. And that was before they lost All-Pro guard Zach Martin in the first quarter against the Cardinals due to a concussion. The mental and emotional gain and growth of your football team is always the last component to come and develop to the level you need to be successful, McCarthy said. Obviously, ours is not quite where we want it to be right now. We haven't handled the adversity in games. I mean, it's an unfortunate part of the game when players do get injured, but we had a chance to prepare for this team. You have to overcome the adverse situations in the game. Yet, despite all of the storm clouds, there could be some sun on the horizon. Monday's loss dropped the Cowboys to 2-4, but they remain in first place in the NFC East, and they'll stay in the division for the next 2 weeks as they travel to take on the Washington football team, 1-5, on Sunday, and then to Philadelphia to face the Eagles, 1-4-1, on November 1st. Yeah, I think that's the reality of the National Football League, McCarthy said. When asked if he took any solace in being in first place, I'm just irritated with the way we performed. We need to get this turnover ratio. We need to get it right. It's not right now. ISD wraps up season with loss to Nebraska City Lourdes on Monday. Iowa School for the Deaf concluded its season on Monday, falling to Nebraska City Lourdes in 3 sets. Reflecting on this season, ISD head coach Katrina Landolt is encouraged by the development and future of the team. It's hard to believe that our season is over. We saw a lot of good things, she said. Our newcomer Hope Marapa showed a lot of improvement in attempting to go for the ball. We had a lot more attempts to get 3 hits before getting it over the net. Our setter, Ali Selwood, is starting to get a better feel of the game. Janessa Pattens and Ashley Vera Nieto have been doing a great job of recognizing where the ball is going. Callie Nipper has stepped up in her role as a leader this year. The players look up to her. Brittany Adame has also shown a great deal of support to her teammates, especially in the end of the season. We will be missing our seniors next year, Nicole Jurgens and Sterling Aragon. They were a great addition to our team. Nebraska Lourdes is 25-25-25-3. Iowa School for the Deaf 0-10, 17-11-9-0. Rays will look to even series with Dodgers in Game 2. Tampa Bay Rays 14-20, first in the AL East versus the Los Angeles Dodgers 43-17, first in the NL West. Arlington, Texas, Wednesday, 8:08 p.m. EDT. Line: Dodgers favored by 11 over 2 runs. Over under is 8 runs. World Series: Los Angeles leads the series 1-0. Bottom line: The Dodgers were 21-9 on their home turf in 2020. Los Angeles has a team batting average of .259 this postseason. Mookie Betts has led them with an average of .327, including 7 extra base hits and 6 RBIs. The Rays were 20-11 on the road in 2020. Tampa Bay has a team slugging percentage of .400 this postseason. Andy Arozarena leads them with a mark of .810, including 11 extra base hits and 10 RBIs. Regular season top performers, AJ Pollock leads the Dodgers with 16 home runs and has 34 RBIs. Brandon Lowe leads the Rays with 25 extra base hits and 37 RBIs. Last 10 games, Dodgers 8-2, .276 batting average, 3.14 ERA, outscored opponents by 34 runs. Rays 8-2, .233 batting average, 2.72 ERA, outscored opponents by 15 runs. Injuries, Dodgers, Jimmy Nelson, back, Caleb Ferguson, left elbow. Rays, Chaz Rowe, elbow, Cody Reed, finger, Colin Poche, elbow, Andrew Kittredge, elbow, Yanni Chirinos, elbow, Jalen Beck's elbow. And that brings us to the end of today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for October 21st, 2020. The Nonpareil can be heard each weekday at 3 p.m. Iris Volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about today's broadcast or any Iris program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 877-404-4747. I'm Alex Lemke from Drake University in Des Moines. Thank you for listening.
In the People's Pharmacy Health Headlines, the Food and Drug Administration has announced 2 drug recalls this week. Sandoz is pulling all of its prescription ranitidine capsules because testing detected a suspected carcinogen called NDMA. Health authorities in Canada, much of Europe, and Taiwan have already issued recalls for Zantac and generic ranitidine. The FDA has not yet asked other U.S. distributors to pull their ranitidine products. Ranitidine is an H2 antagonist used to treat ulcers and acid reflux. In addition, Torrent Pharmaceuticals is recalling multiple lots of the blood pressure drug Losartan. This action is related to detection of the impurity NMBA. This nitrosamine compound is also a probable human carcinogen. Torrent has now recalled more than 300 lots of blood pressure medicines during the past year.
Aspirin has been getting mixed reviews lately. Earlier this year, the American Heart Association and the American College of Cardiology said that low-dose aspirin should only be used by older people at high risk of strokes or heart attacks. Others, they said, would be more likely to be harmed. Now, though, researchers from Roswell Park Comprehensive Cancer Center report that patients with head and neck cancer have a better chance of survival if they take low-dose aspirin while undergoing treatment. An additional 8% of patients taking the 81 milligram daily dose were still alive 5 years after treatment compared to those not taking aspirin. A different study at Roswell Park compared aspirin versus no aspirin among 164 patients being treated for early-stage non-small cell lung cancer. The patients got precision radiation therapy. 2 years after treatment, 57% of those taking low-dose aspirin were still alive, compared to 48% of those who did not take the drug. The U.S. Preventive Services Task Force has also recommended that obstetricians consider recommending low-dose aspirin to patients at risk of preeclampsia. This complication of pregnancy can be extremely serious for both mother and baby. Women taking low-dose aspirin are 24% less likely to develop preeclampsia.
Scientists suggest that the Puerto Rican culinary tradition of incorporating sofrito into many dishes might help explain a lower rate of breast cancer there. This condiment is made with onions, garlic, peppers, cilantro, and a related herb, rucao. Epidemiologists found that Puerto Rican women who ate lots of garlic and onions, including sofrito, were 67% less likely to get breast cancer than those who never ate sofrito. The total intake of onions and garlic was important, not only the use of sofrito. The researchers point out that onions and garlic are rich in flavanols and sulfur-containing compounds that have anti-cancer activity.
Despite lots of information about how to eat healthily, Americans are still getting too much of their energy from low-quality carbohydrates. Nutrition scientists drew this conclusion from analyzing nutrition health and examination survey data from 1999 to 2016. Although the American diet got a little better over that time frame, the change was modest. Only 9% of calories in a typical American diet come from whole fruits and whole grains. About 42% comes from highly refined grains, added sugar, and starchy vegetables such as potatoes. The estimated healthy eating index went from 55.7 to 57.7. Although this change is statistically significant, it leaves plenty of room for improvement.
Americans are often exhorted to walk on the sunny side or look for the silver lining. Can such a cheery attitude influence your health? A recent meta-analysis in JAMA Network Open suggests that optimistic individuals are less likely to suffer heart attacks, strokes, angina, and death from cardiovascular causes. The analysis included 15 studies with a total of more than 200,000 participants. A pessimistic attitude increased people's risk of cardiac problems. The author suggests that health professionals might want to come up with interventions to reduce pessimism and promote optimism, especially in cardiac rehab programs. They express the hope that their study might stimulate research into the heart benefits of a sense of purpose or gratitude. And that's the health news from the People's Pharmacy this week.